Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots, and partially solar-powered community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen so you can take notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. This week, I'd like to talk a little bit about prime borrowers rather than subprime borrowers. And there's an article called The Foreclosure Crisis Phase 2, The Negative Equity Dilemma by Alyssa Figura in the Christian Science Monitor. And the issue is that many prime borrowers are now being caught between devalued homes and job losses. And the question is, will Congress step in? For almost a quarter of a century, Cynthia Johnson, a Boston homeowner, has paid the mortgage on her three-bedroom single-family house on time. But in July, for the first time, she'll miss a payment. I'm on the bank's doorstep at this point, saying, "The savings are gone. I can't pay you as promised," she said. Unless something changes, Ms. Johnson, not her real name, is set to join the nearly 2.4 million Americans with prime loans seriously delinquent on their mortgages. They are the new face of the housing crisis. Unlike subprime borrowers, most of these homeowners did everything right. They bought houses they could afford and used standard mortgages. But falling home prices and a protracted recession have pushed them into a classic squeeze. They can't keep up their mortgage payments because someone in the household has lost his or her job. They can't sell because they owe more than the home is worth. In the next 12 months, it's going to be tragic. Most people are just starting to fall behind now, said Avi Liss, a lawyer helping homeowners avoid foreclosure in the Boston area. According to the Center for Responsible Lending, a nonprofit research and policy group, as many as 9 million homeowners could go into foreclosure between 2009 and 2012. Is there a solution? Yes, but it's controversial. Congress would have to force banks to write off part of the homeowner's trouble loan as a way to keep them in their homes. There are plenty of reasons to avoid this course. Chief among them is the moral hazard. If banks write down one homeowner's loan because of hardship, what's to keep other homeowners from claiming hardship too? And the losses don't accrue to some faceless bank. They add up for individual shareholders and pension funds that have money tied up in mortgage loans. In a way, reducing principal is like rewarding homeowners for backing out of an obligation, said Stan Longhofer, director of the Center for Real Estate at Wichita State University in Wichita, Kansas. But the current program isn't working either, critics say, and the debt write-down happens anyway, whether a homeowner goes through foreclosure or the house is relinquished in a short sale. So isn't it better, they ask, for the bank to take its losses early and keep the owner in his home? Osazi Egharevba, a Nigerian immigrant who came to the Boston area in 2000 after his wife passed away, worked two jobs and saved enough to bring over his five children in 2006. That same year, he purchased a two-family home. He could afford the $3,950 monthly payments by renting out the first floor. Then Mr. Egharevba lost one job and the extra $800 a week it brought in and started missing payments. Deeply underwater on the $510,000 property, owing more than it was worth. He was foreclosed on this past winter after 5 failed attempts at attaining a loan modification. My children were going to be on the street because there was no home, he said. But he stayed in the house. In April 2010, a nonprofit called Boston Community Capital was able to buy the home and sell it back to him for $296,000, the home's current value. His monthly payment has fallen to a manageable $2,300. Ekariba doesn't get off scot-free, though. He is bound to share with BCC any profit he makes when he sells the property. There's no incentive for someone to do this to make money, says Patricia Hanratty, who runs the loan program at BCC. This is for people who desperately want to save their homes. In the year that the program has been running, almost 70 homes have been either sold back or rented to foreclosed homeowners. None have redefaulted. When the group buys a foreclosed property, it routinely asks the selling bank if it wants to participate in the shared equity deal. Everyone has declined the offer. They said it was too complicated. It wasn't something they were used to doing. They didn't want to get involved in it, said Ms. Hanratty. Maybe that will turn. That will change in time. There is a precedent for widespread principal reduction on property loans. During the farm crisis of the 1980s, young farmers who had bought farmland at inflated prices suddenly saw crop prices plunge and, soon after, land prices fall as well. It was a debt squeeze not unlike today's crisis for underwater homeowners who have lost their job. Seeing the unfolding rural disaster, Congress created a new chapter in the bankruptcy code. It allowed bankruptcy judges to modify loans, including a partial debt write-down so family farmers could stay on their farm. People who will pull themselves out of trouble and be good credit risks again, those are the people who merit this kind of intervention and who will also help stabilize the markets, said Neil Harl, an agricultural economist at Iowa State University, who helped write the bankruptcy language. In 2008, Senator Harry Reid, Democrat of Nevada, introduced a similar bill for the housing crisis. But the measure languished, in large part because, at the time, subprime borrowers were in the eye of the storm and many of them had stretched to buy homes they really could not afford. Will the new foreclosure wave of prime borrowers change the political calculus? Professor Harl isn't optimistic. Unfortunately, people in Congress listen to lobbyists, said Harl. They tend to drown out those that don't have as much money. Instead, homeowners facing foreclosure can try to get their loan modified through the administration's Home Affordable Modification Program, or HAMP. Typically, the bank servicing the loan tries to make monthly mortgage payments affordable by extending the mortgage to a 40-year loan and reducing the interest rate. 1 year into the program, however, only about 300,000 of an estimated 4 million eligible homeowners have received permanent loan modifications. It is pretty much not working, said Nadine Cohen, a lawyer with Greater Boston Legal Services, which helps homeowners obtain loan modifications. Now, why do modification requests get denied? That's partly because loan servicers were unprepared for the massive influx of loan modification requests. It's also because a loan modification is difficult to qualify for. This is particularly true for owners with big mortgages whose income has decreased, like Cynthia Johnson. Her spiral toward foreclosure began with a divorce in 2006, which halved her $160,000 a year household income. She took equity out of her home to buy her husband out of the mortgage. When she was forced to take a $22,000 pay cut, her $2,000 monthly mortgage payments became impossible to manage. She's gone through about $14,000 in savings to keep paying her mortgage, which now eats up more than 40% of her paycheck. Still, she's about $60,000 underwater, and because of that, she can't refinance again or borrow off the equity on her home. Johnson appealed to her loan servicer to adjust her monthly payments, but because she is not yet in arrears, her request was denied. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. And I'm currently talking about a loan modification issue from the Christian Science Monitor. For a loan modification, lenders test to determine whether it is more beneficial for the investor to modify the loan and get a lower monthly payment or foreclose on the home. In many cases where the person's income has dropped substantially, they decide it's better to foreclose, explained Ms. Cohen. For homeowners who do qualify for a modification, few are offered principal reductions. Because less than 30% of the mortgages modified so far, about 98,000, included any reduction in the loan amount, many homeowners with modifications remain underwater. Some blame continued negative equity for HAM's high redefault rate. About half of the loans modified through the program go into default. The Treasury Department has taken sweeping steps to address problems with the program. In late March, it announced a new initiative for unemployed homeowners. Starting this month, they will be given a 3-month forbearance period before applying for a loan modification. Underwater homeowners current on their loans will also be able to apply for refinancing from the Federal Housing Administration. This is the first time that modifications for people not yet in arrears will be performed as part of the program. Perhaps most significantly, HAMP will now incorporate principal reduction into the financing process. Servicers will be required to consider the advantages of reducing principal to match the current value of the home. As an incentive, banks that reduce principal on loans will also get a fee based on how much debt was forgiven and how deeply underwater the modified loan was beforehand. The changes to HAMP have been hailed by housing and consumer lending advocates as a move in the right direction, but some insist that Treasury's reluctance to make one key change could significantly limit the revamped program's reach. Principal reductions remain voluntary for banks. As long as servicers can opt out of reducing principal, they will, say housing advocates, even when the other options are only foreclosure or a short sale, which ultimately result in the property being devalued to the current market price. The way loan servicers get paid is that they earn a percentage of the principal balance of their book of business, said Julia Gordon, a Washington-based senior policy counsel for the Center for Responsible Lending. So when the dollar value of the principal outstanding on a mortgage is reduced, so are the bank's fees, she added. You can see right there why the servicer doesn't want to write down principal. On the other side, mortgage bankers, though, insist that the argument is misguided. The servicer would find some very minimal reduction in fees if a principal reduction is made, said Jay Brinkman, chief economist for the Mortgage Bankers Association. But they're not the one making the decision. They make the recommendations, but the principal reduction has to be made by the investor. Ultimately, the issue boils down to balancing risks. The possibility that banks are pushing too many people into foreclosure versus the danger that banks' leniency will encourage more homeowners to default so they can get their mortgage principal reduced. There are effective ways to modify loans, like reducing interest, that won't encourage such defaults, Mr. Brinkman says. While principal reduction might improve things for one borrower, will it help the economy if 10 more homeowners default and ask for a reduction? So that's from the foreclosure crisis, the negative equity dilemma, from the Christian Science Monitor. Now I'd like to move on to the second segment of the show, where we have been studying the two-income trap, Why Middle-Class Parents Are Going Broke, by Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. I give an important credit, as the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren and her daughter, Amelia Warren Tyagi, who are two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two-Income Trap. You can also revisit all of these shows by going to the archives at www.kruufm.com. and look under life and debt and get some valuable instruction on dealing with debt, past, present, and future. So at this point in the book, we were discussing how the proposed bankruptcy bill in the year 2001 and 2002 got defeated by grassroots groups like women that successfully flexed their muscles against the most well-funded lobbying group in America, showing that the world of strong women could defeat the credit industry if key groups are rallied against them. So what was key to the action? In some ways, it wasn't just putting forth the facts. Congress had already impaneled a bankruptcy commission to write 1,100 pages of facts, which few even bothered to read. Not atypical in that process. The real key, according to Professor Warren, was to match up the politics of financial distress with the interests of the rest of the country. What we saw at that time was the Right to Life organizations put a face on those who would be affected by the Schumer Amendment to the bankruptcy law. So as a reminder, in a strange twist of politics, the credit industry's version of the proposed bankruptcy bill had been supported by Senator Charles Schumer of New York, who had garnered strong support among women's groups for his pro-choice politics. Ever responsive to his constituents, Senator Schumer inserted a provision into the bankruptcy bill that would make it more difficult for abortion clinic protesters to discharge judgments entered against them if they were sued for their protest activities, much in the same way drunk drivers and embezzlers cannot use bankruptcy to discharge judgments against themselves. In response, the pro-life group showcased stories of elderly grandmothers and church-going families who protested abortion as a matter of conscience. Then on the other hand, the pro-choice organizations put their own face on the issue, spotlighting violent abortion protesters who had found a loophole that let them get away with breaking the law. Professor Warren's highlight was that there is a lesson. To put sound economic policies on the political agenda, families also need to find a face. So long as they are, quote, debtors or, quote, bankrupts, their needs can be easily dismissed. Instead, they need to be seen as members of powerful constituencies, members of groups that command the respect and the fear of the political elite. So what Professor Warren emphasizes is families in financial trouble must be depicted as they really are. Parents of young children, non-resident fathers paying child support, suburban homeowners, African-American middle-class families, single mothers, families sending a child to college, multi-generational Hispanic families, and so forth. Most of all, the groups that defend these people need to organize against those who are picking their constituents' pockets. Elizabeth and Amelia say the case is not hard to make. They use African-Americans as an example. For decades, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, the NAACP, and other minority rights groups have lobbied to expand African-American home ownership, and they have been at least somewhat successful in their efforts. We saw how predatory and subprime lenders threatened to unravel those hard-won gains and have had a lot of success in it, which has come out in the last 3 years. Every year, more than 300,000 Black and Hispanic homeowners file for bankruptcy in a desperate attempt to hold on to their homes. Hispanic homeowners are nearly 3 times more likely than white homeowners to file for bankruptcy, and Black homeowners are nearly 6 times more likely. The same signs of distress are evident outside the bankruptcy courts, too. When Professor Warren analyzed unpublished data from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, she found that among families who had purchased a home with an FHA-backed mortgage, African Americans were twice as likely as white homeowners to lose their home in foreclosure. Many of us may not realize it, but payday lenders and subprime mortgage companies deliberately targeted minority neighborhoods, confident that they could get away with fleecing these families. And they did. Literally billions of dollars flowed out of the communities that could least afford it, directly into the pockets of giant lenders and their shareholders. Elizabeth and Amelia were not the first to document these kinds of problems. Minority rights groups were well aware of the dangers of predatory lending. And I'll continue in a minute. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to the point that minority rights groups were well aware of predatory lending. However, there is an important question of how high economic issues should rank in the list of priorities. When Senator Trent Lott seemingly expressed his nostalgia for a segregated America, minority groups around the country barraged the talk shows and newspapers, and Lott was ultimately stripped of his powerful position as majority leader of the Senate. Another example was when Texaco executives were accused of using racial slurs to refer to African Americans. The company was boycotted, sued for millions of dollars, and forced to adopt new practices to ensure that its black employees had better opportunities. But when a Citibank official said in a sworn affidavit that she regularly added extra fees to a home mortgage if someone was a minority, there was little response. Citibank quietly agreed to a cash settlement with the FTC, and there were no press releases from the NAACP, no interviews on the evening news, no calls for Citibank's highly visible CEO, Sandy Wheel at that time, to resign. We see subprime lending, payday loans, and a host of predatory high-interest loan products targeting minority neighborhoods. Professor Warren says these should be called by their true names: legally sanctioned corporate plans to steal from minorities. Now, this is a professor from Harvard, probably one of the top legal minds in the country today. Again, legally sanctioned corporate plans to steal from minorities. She plodded on and said that many years ago, a host of community groups worked together to oppose discriminatory lending and to help pass the Community Reinvestment Act, despite stiff opposition from the banking industry, which is continuing today, as we saw in the article up front at the beginning of the show. But she said back in 2002, it's time for these groups to come together again to eliminate the modern version of economic discrimination, which parades under different names but has the same devastating effects. And since that time in 2002, nothing substantial has happened, and we have seen a number of things take place that actually show it has worsened. Elizabeth and Amelia go on to a specific woman's issue. Minority groups should not be asked to bear the burden on their own, she says. Women's groups also need to pick up the mantle of economic reform. Middle-class financial distress may sound like a gender-neutral issue, but it is not. When we look at the two decades just prior to the turn of the century, the number of single-filing women declaring bankruptcy grew by more than 600%. Women with children were more likely to lose their homes and more likely to be late on their bills. And single women with children at the time this book was written in 2002 were three times more likely to go bankrupt than men without children. Professor Warren says that the notion that women should fight for economic reform is hardly new. From the early days of the struggle for equal pay, for equal work, women's groups have protested for financial justice. But the issue of economic reform for middle-class women is often shunted aside by other priorities. For example, the NOW Legal Defense and Education Fund vigorously opposed the credit industry-backed bankruptcy bill, doing the painstaking legwork to convince nearly 30 other women's groups as disparate as Church Women United, Hadassah, and the YWCA to join the fight. Yet now Legal Defense also offered its very public support to who was a senator back then, Joseph Biden, featuring him as women's strongest ally in the Senate because he supported the Violence Against Women Act. Apparently, his support of that bill trumped any concerns the group might have had over the fact that Senator Biden is the leading Democratic proponent and one of the strongest supporters of the very bankruptcy bill against which now Legal Defense had fought so hard. So it gets very murky and muddy in dealing with these issues. And much of it comes down to money. Women's groups have too few dollars and too little woman power to fight every injustice. But Professor Warren says there is another lesson in the tale of the bankruptcy bill. Women's issues are not just about childbearing or domestic violence. If it were framed properly, middle-class economic reform just might become the issue that could galvanize millions of mainstream women to join the fight for women's issues. The numbers are certainly there. In 2002, more women filed bankruptcy papers than received college diplomas. More women with children searched for a bankruptcy lawyer than sought subsidized daycare. And in a statistic with specialized significance for Senator Biden, who is now vice president, more women were victimized by predatory lenders than sought protection from an abusive husband or boyfriend. So financial priorities have to take higher relief in helping these groups, particularly women. Of course, the point is not to discredit other worthy causes or to pit one disadvantaged group against another. Professor Warren does not suggest that battered women deserve less help or that subsidized daycare is unimportant. Hardly. The point was simply that family economics should not be left to giant corporations and paid lobbyists like we see every day. Senators should not be allowed to sell out women in the morning and be heralded as their friend in the evening, as in the example of the then Senator Biden. Middle class women need help, and right now no one is putting their economic interests first. And this book was written in 2002, and this continues to today, July of 2010. And political groups on the conservative end of the political spectrum should step up as well. Groups such as the Family Research Council and Focus on the Family organize their political and educational activities around the family. But economics are nestled at the core of family values. Any group that is serious about lowering divorce rates should focus on reducing the economic stress that strains a marriage. Any group that cares about children should be vitally interested in how home mortgages are marketed and how tens of thousands of kids are getting kicked out of their homes today. And any group that thinks mom ought to have the option to stay at home with the kids should be powerfully concerned about the debt trap that chains millions of middle-class women to their offices. And we will continue this story next week. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.